Good evening. Welcome back. You remember last time we left Naomi, had returned from Moab to Bethlehem, and was living in pain. I feel sometimes like those old radio shows where they say, you remember our hero last time, and this is brought to you by Wheaties, the breakfast of champions. But maybe what Naomi needs more than anything else is a dose of Paul Harvey, the rest of the story. Because that's where we turn tonight, is in chapter 2, the rest of the story. Naomi has experienced the bitter circumstances of death of her husband, death of her two sons, and now she's returning with her daughter-in-law and thinking that that's it for her life, not knowing that she is on the brink of the turnaround where the Lord is going to show himself faithful to her. It reminded me of a story of a missionary couple, a Swedish Pentecostal missionary couple. The woman's name was Svea Flood. And they, I think in the 1900s, 1920 or something, they went to the Belgian Congo to preach the gospel and lived in a village. Well, they didn't even actually live in the village because the chief was suspicious of them, wouldn't let them live in the village. They had to make a hut outside the village. And they had no contact with anyone in the village, except the chief allowed one little boy to go out a couple times a week to bring them food. So they were praying for the Lord to open up a way to preach the gospel to this village, and it never happened. So Svea thought, I only have access to one boy. I will share the gospel with him. And sure enough, he accepted the Lord. But then Svea got pregnant, gave birth to a daughter, and she was so weakened from malaria that a couple weeks after the birth, she died. Well, her husband, something snapped, and he took the baby, gave it to another missionary couple, and left the mission field, went back to Sweden, saying, God has ruined my life for nothing. And left the Lord for many decades. He needed to know the rest of the story, which his daughter found out through leafing through a Swedish missionary magazine, and came to find out that that boy remained faithful to the Lord even though he was alone in that village, and was able to convince the chief to let him build a school. And in that school, he led his children to the Lord. And they went home and were able to lead their families to the Lord. And before you know it, the chief himself has accepted Jesus, and the whole village of 600 people have come to faith in the Lord. And this father of Svea thought his life had been wasted, but in fact, it was a living reminder that unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains alone. But if it does, it brings forth much fruit. Well, the daughter ended up being in ministry herself and was at a missions conference one year in London. And she heard the head of the Pentecostal church in what was the Belgian Congo, where they went, but now it's Zaire, teaching about what the Lord had been doing. And she went to him after the session and asked, did you happen to hear of such and such a village? Yeah, I did. I grew up in that village. Well, did you ever hear of a woman by the name of Svea Flood? He said, yeah. I was a 12-year-old boy taking food to her, and she led me to the Lord. And now this is a man that was responsible for 100,000 believers, all because one person gave their life. And we look at the providence of God and we wonder, why does one person live many years of fruitful service and another one just leads one person to the Lord, and yet that one person makes a difference in all of life? And that's what Naomi is about to find. If you turn in your Bibles to Ruth chapter 2, and we don't have the overhead, so if you got addicted to looking at the Bible on the screen, you'll have to blow the dust off the pages of the Bible and read it as we go. The end of chapter 1, we see the glimmer of hope that the author tells us that Ruth and Naomi come from Moab, and it's the beginning of the barley harvest. I meant to ask you last week, and I forgot, to read chapter 2 and look for evidence of the providence of God, and then focus on the blessing of Boaz and the blessing of Naomi. So if we look at 2:1, we're introduced to the third main character of the book of Ruth, and that is Boaz. And it says, now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. So Boaz is introduced to us in two ways. He's a relative of Naomi, and he is a worthy man. Some translations say he's a man of standing or a man of wealth. Sometimes it's used of military valor, but sometimes it's used as character. And that's how it's used in the book of Ruth. Boaz himself in chapter 3 will describe Ruth as a woman of virtue, of character like this. And in 2:2, Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him whose sight I shall find favor. And Naomi said to her, go, my daughter. So we've been looking at the providence of God and how the Lord leads and governs his universe. But that doesn't absolve us from responsibility of initiative. And Ruth then, you know, volunteers to go glean in the field to gain food for them. Now, gleaning, I'm sure you know, is the practice of going through a field after the harvesters have done their work and finding whatever is left over. There was a provision in the law of God to make provision for the poor, the sojourner, the widow, the fatherless, in order to gain food from the crops after the harvesters had gone through. And it's so important that if we think of the book of Leviticus as lots of minute rules and regulations. But the theme of Leviticus in chapter 19 is, you shall be holy, for the Lord your God is holy. And all the rules and regulations are designed to keep the people holy so they can enter into the presence of a holy God. And right in the middle of Leviticus 19, as it's going through the sacrifices, it says, don't harvest your field edge to edge, but leave it for the poor and the sojourner. That the holiness of God is not just what we do for him alone, but it's how we treat the weak and the poor. In Leviticus 23, it goes through all the details of the Sabbath and the Passover and the Feast of Weeks and all the different feasts and festivals, and right in the middle of it is, don't harvest your crops or take your figs, all of them. You leave the rest for the poor. If you forget something, don't go back and pick it up. That's for the poor. We've looked at Deuteronomy several times. Same thing, that the Lord made provision for the widow, the orphan, and the sojourner to gain food. But Ruth says, I'll go glean where I might find favor. The problem is that just because the law says something doesn't mean the people say something. And in the days of judges, where they're ignorant and disobedient to the law, she doesn't know whether she will actually find welcome. But she takes the initiative and looks for someone to find favor. It shouldn't be that way. It's not up to the whim or the prejudice of the landowner. It's a requirement of God, his care for the poor. But she goes, she looks, and in verse 3, we find that she sets out, went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. I can almost hear the, you know, the air quotes of the writer of Ruth saying she just happened to come. Of all the parcels of field that she could have gone to, she just happened to come to the one by Boaz. Some of the translations say, as luck would have it, or it turned out. The King James, her hap was that she fell into the parcel of land owned by Boaz. We looked at providence and the mysterious nature of how God works with human choice in order to provide what he wants to accomplish. And it's random. It appears to be accidental, random, a chance encounter. But behind it is the Lord working his will. That Ruth didn't know, she couldn't plan it, she couldn't choose it, but the Lord knew and led her to the right field. And 2:4, behold. Like, I mean, if you were sleeping while you read 2:1, 2 and 3, behold, here's Boaz. Now, I'm picturing out of central casting. I have a screenplay of Ruth and Boaz. Sort of the camera zooms in on Ruth, and she's been gleaning all day, but there's just a slight hint of perspiration that just highlights her perfect makeup, and her beauty is enhanced. Her hair is done by a professional stylist. There's just one lock that hangs down that just makes her more beautiful. And there she is, she's laboring, gleaning, waiting in the hut. And here comes Boaz. He's striding across the field. He's taking off his shirt. We can see the six-pack abs of his, and his muscles are flexing. His smile is warm as he greets his laborers. His eyes are sharp and kind. His face is tanned and rugged and handsome. There's a note, see if George Clooney is available, or if Sean Connery can look a little younger and be our Boaz. You can see his eyes. He sees Ruth, and he doesn't say anything, but you can hear his thoughts. This is why I never married. This enchantment of beauty I have longed for my whole life, and here she is. The Lord has finally brought her to me. That's the scene, the screenplay. And it's written by people that have been catechized by romantic comedies and Hallmark movies. It is not the Bible. What is in the Bible is a godly man that greets his workers in verse 4, Yahweh be with you. And they answer back, Yahweh bless you. And if we know anything from our author, is he or she does not give extra words where they're not necessary. They're all important. It's condensed. And what we see here is that Boaz's mind is not on romance at all. His mind is on godliness. And his character is shown in that he blesses his people that work for him. And they're not cheap cliches, platitudes, but in fact, this is his heart. And he sees Ruth and asks who she is. Actually, he asks, whose young woman is this? Meaning, what family does this woman come from in verse 5? Boaz said to his young man who is in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, she's the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. And she said, "Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers." So she came and she continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest. Now, the commentators argue about whether she worked all day and then took a short rest, or whether she was waiting all day for Boaz to give permission. The point is that the focus of the text has moved from Naomi to Boaz. We'll get back to Naomi at the end of the chapter. And then in verse 8, we have the response. And this tells the heart of Boaz, that his mind is not on romance. His mind is not on sexual attraction. His mind is on concern for the weak and the vulnerable and the poor. So Boaz in verse 8 said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter." He's obviously older. He may be as old as Naomi. He's of a different generation, but he treats her as he would treat his own daughter. "Do not glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. It's the days of the judges. You don't know what kind of peril there is in other fields where people are less godly than Boaz. In verse 9, "Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping. Go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." There is something in the character of a godly person that immediately looks to protect and defend and provide for the weak and the vulnerable. You can say that the character of someone is revealed in how they treat people that they are less on the status line ladder than they are. And here, there's an instinctive attitude to help the vulnerable. And Ruth, in verse 10, fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I'm a foreigner?" Here again, she had every right to glean according to the law of God, but she doesn't base anything on entitlement or rights, but on grace. And Sinclair Ferguson has a little book on Ruth called Faithful God. And in it, he says, "The times in which we live must rank among the most ungrateful in history." And that was written in 2005. I doubt if anything has come along since then that would change Sinclair Ferguson to change his mind. That here, Ruth, I mean, we're looking at the character that God values in Boaz reaching out to protect and to provide for the weak, and the humility and appreciation of Ruth that doesn't demand rights but accepts by grace the favor that that Boaz gives her. We could learn a lot from this, couldn't we? I mean, there's a series I used to watch on TV by Mike Rowe, Dirty Jobs. And what he would do is show a job that nobody wants to do, but somebody does it, and it makes society go better. And that's gleaning. I mean, there is no lower, more menial job and hard work than gleaning. Even the actor Ashton Kutcher in an interview said, "I never had a job that I felt was beneath me." And that's humility, that I'm not too good for any job. If the Lord is providing for food for Naomi and Ruth, it's good enough. And Boaz answers her in verse 11. And he doesn't answer because she's a hot babe. He answers, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me. How you left your father and mother in your native land and have come to a people that you did not know before." This is a godly man recognizing a godly, virtuous action by Ruth. That she left her land and people, clung to Naomi. This is not romance on the part of Boaz. It's hesed. It's the kindness of God. It's the compassion of God. It's treating those that are in need graciously and kindly the way the Lord treats the ones that are in need. He sees what she has done. And then we get to, in verse 12, the first blessing of the chapter. We've seen blessings before. In 1:8, Naomi blesses the daughters-in-law and prays that Yahweh would be kind to them, would show his hesed for them, and they would find a place of refuge, of safety. And now Boaz is blessing Ruth. In verse 12, may the Lord, may Yahweh repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. He's praying that she would be compensated for her sacrifice, for her losses. Now, we are corrupt people. present company accepted, Sean. I am a corrupt person. And ordinarily, the immediate reaction is, well, that's good. So if I do this, then the Lord has to do that. There's a crass monetary sense of what I do. God then is obligated to pay me back. And in fact, it uses words of compensation, of negotiation, of price, that the Lord would pay her back for what she's done. And it's easy to think of, again, entitlement, that I've done this and now God owes me something. But I think that's wrong. And the reason I think it's wrong is because the foundation of his prayer is at the end of the prayer. So if we read it from the bottom up, we get a different sense. For what he says is, may a full reward be given to you by Yahweh, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. That here, the essential thing is that she not only left her people, her family, her household, not only left the people of Moab and the land of Moab, not only left the gods of Moab, but she has come to seek refuge under the wings of Yahweh. Then this concept of the wings of Yahweh, you remember when he delivered the nation of Israel from Egypt, he said, I bore you on eagle's wings, the power, the strength. But maybe more importantly is how many times you read in the Psalms of the psalmist saying, I have sought refuge under the wings of Yahweh. That in Psalm 57, be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me, for in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I will take refuge. God will send then his steadfast love, his hesed. Or Psalm 91, he who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. He will cover you with his pinions, and under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and a buckler. Psalm 34, I'll bless the Lord at all times. His praise will continually be in my mouth. I sought the Lord. He answered me and delivered me from my fears. Those that look to him are radiant. Their faces will never be put to shame. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the one who takes refuge in him. Fear the Lord, for those that fear him will have no lack. And what Boaz is praying, he sees that Ruth has put her faith in Yahweh. She has sought refuge and safety and security and provision in Yahweh. not just in Bethlehem, but in Yahweh himself. And it's inconceivable that God would let her down. His prayer is, this one that has sought refuge in the Lord, you will minister to her, you will bless her, you will fulfill her need. This is what his prayer is, that the one that seeks refuge in the presence of God will not be let down. He will provide and protect and preserve them. The covenant blessings of God are a promise of his supply for their need. And what Boaz is saying is, she is in the covenant with Almighty God, that she has come and now will receive the covenant promises that his people receive. And Ruth, again, she says, I found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I'm not one of your servants. And then in 14, Boaz gives more. At mealtime, Boaz said to her, come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine. And she sat beside the reapers and he passed to her roasted grain. She ate until she was satisfied and had some left over. And when she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, let her glean among the sheaves. Do not reproach her. You're not allowed to do that. The law was, after the harvesters go by, then you can go. But she's going to glean among the sheaves. And also pull out some of the bundles for her and leave it for her to glean. Do not rebuke her. That here, Boaz begins to be the protection and provision that he prays for. And I would just say, be careful what you pray for. Be careful who you pray for, because you may be the answer to that prayer. Apparently, Boaz was listening carefully on Sunday mornings to the book of James. Because he doesn't say, be warmed and be filled. He, in fact, acts in her behalf, in protection and in provision for her. This is what's going on in the chapter. It's not romance. It's the grace of God in godly people reaching out to perform what God himself wants done. So in verse 17, she gleaned in the field until evening, and she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. The commentators will tell you how many parts of a bushel an ephah is. And I read anywhere from 30 pounds of grain to 50 pounds of grain. That's a lot for coming after the harvesters. It's so much, in fact, that when Naomi hears about it, she says, whoa, what field did you go into, daughter? And here I can just picture her staggering under the load back to Naomi to give this food. What are we seeing here? Remember Naomi's statement, I went out full and Yahweh brought me back empty. Well, now we're beginning to see the reversal, that she will be full again. So Ruth ate and was satisfied and had more to take to give to Naomi. And now she's got a load of food that will last for several weeks at least. Again, Sinclair Ferguson, he said, this is what the Lord does when someone seeks refuge from him. That what the one thing that Naomi really needed to lose was self-reliance. And when you lose self-reliance and seek refuge under the wing of Yahweh, you can expect his provision to be yours. So verse 19, Ruth took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She said, you go, girl. No, that was the Hebrew. You go, girl. And she brought out and gave her what food she had left over and was satisfied. And her mother-in-law said, where did you glean today? Where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. And she told her mother-in-law where she had worked. And she said, the man's name with whom I work today is, pregnant pause, drum roll, Boaz. And when Naomi hears the word Boaz, a light has turned on. She's been living in darkness for 10 years. She's been in Moab after famine. She's lost her husband. She's lost her sons. She comes back with nothing but what she can carry, and she has nothing to look forward to. But now she sees a light at the end of the tunnel. She hears the name Boaz, and she realizes in verse 20, Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed by Yahweh, whose kindness, or hesed, has not forsaken the living or the dead. And Naomi also said to her, the man is a close relative. And in verse 1, it said he was a relative. Now we find out he's a near relative, one of our redeemers. So the problem is that gleaning is great as a provision, but it's temporary. It's a stopgap. They need a full redemption. And now she's thinking, maybe there's a chance. But she blesses Boaz. May he be blessed by Yahweh, because he has not forsaken the living or the dead. That is, he has a concern for the family, that to provide for and to preserve this family. And it's a little ambiguous. She blesses Boaz, but then she said, whose kindness? And we don't know if she means that it's Yahweh's kindness, that he has not forsaken the living and the dead, or is it Boaz's kindness, that he has not forsaken the living or the dead? Bottom line, I think, is both, and it doesn't matter. Because the Lord, when he expresses his character, when he expresses his loving kindness, when he expresses his faithfulness, he is doing it through the character of a godly person in the person of Boaz. That Boaz is the redeemer, but as a redeemer, he points to a greater redeemer. So this is said, if you read to the end of the chapter, you'll see that Ruth stays with the group of Boaz's workers for the next for the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. So for 6 or 7 weeks, she is working with them. She is gleaning, and Naomi is scheming. She's gleaning, and Naomi is scheming. So your assignment for next week is chapter 3. You want to answer the question, what in the world is going on at the threshing floor, and is it immoral? That's the question. But maybe more important, look for themes or words that we have seen before and how they're treated in that chapter. So that's for next week. I just wanted to take a couple minutes and look at what she says, that this man is one of our redeemers. Because this is the next major theme in the book of Ruth, and that is the redeemer. The Bible, the Old Testament, has a couple different Hebrew words for redeemer or redemption, and there are three main features, and not every feature is every time the word is used, but the overall concept of redeemer or redemption, it has these three features. And number one is the release. That is, somebody is set free from captivity, from bondage. It could be bondage in slavery, right? The Lord redeemed his people out of Egyptian bondage. He set them free. They were captive. He set them free. It can be a land that is sold because of a creditor. And redemption is to buy that back, is to set it free. Oftentimes, in a financial crisis, someone may sell himself into slavery in order to pay off the debt. Now, in Israel, the law of God limited slavery to 7 years. 7 years is all you could hold a slave. And so it's really more indentured servitude. There was no such thing as the evil of perpetual slavery and generational slavery in the Bible. That is not God's law at all. And we've been looking a bit at providence and how God rules and governs. And we saw it didn't absolve Ruth of taking initiative. Well, neither does it absolve us of fighting against evil. William Wilberforce, his death is marked July 31st, spent an entire life fighting the slave trade and finally saw it ended in his life. So this slavery in the Old Testament for the people of God was a limited time. But the person would sell himself into captivity to pay off his debts. The release would be to set him free. It's either at 7 years or someone can pay the price to buy him out. And that's the second aspect. That is the ransom. The ransom or price paid to buy somebody back. The person owes a debt, sells himself into slavery. Somebody pays that debt off. They're set free. And sometimes it's a substitute that pays the debt. So the Lord said, I redeemed you at the price of the firstborn of Egypt when I redeemed you from slavery. Therefore, the firstborn is mine. But you can't sacrifice people, so you can pay with a substitute. You can redeem that person with a substitute. So the status is changed by release. The ransom is the price that's paid to buy that freedom. And the third aspect, and this is the aspect that we find in the book of Ruth, that it is a relative, a near relative, or the older translations, a kinsman, is responsibility to redeem the one who is in captivity to preserve the integrity of the family. So it is the redeemer, the kinsman redeemer, the relative that will buy back property that has been sold, that will buy back the freedom of someone that is in captivity, that will even take vengeance when someone kills somebody in the clan. So there's a release of the bondage paid for by a price by a close relative. Coupled with that is the idea of marriage of a widow, which we'll look at next week. Now, I'm sure that you were already thinking, I know a better redeemer than Boaz. For there was one that came and not only released us from temporary bondage, but released us from captivity to sin, released us from captivity to Satan, released us from captivity to the world and its values, and released us even from death. And that one came and paid a price that wasn't corruptible things like silver and gold, but was his own blood as a Lamb of God without spot and without wrinkle. This is the one who the book of Hebrews tells us is not ashamed to call us brothers, that he has taken on the role of the family member, our elder brother, to set us free from these things. And we're going to see that Ruth the Moabitess, the one that's out of Israel, not part of the covenant people, has come now and has begun to enjoy the blessing of the Redeemer. We're all Ruth. If we didn't physically descend from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we're Ruth. And we have come to take shelter under the wings of Yahweh, where he provides protection and he provides supply and a redeemer. There's a hymn writer, Annie Johnson Flint. I like her because she's a Jersey girl. She was orphaned as a young girl and was adopted by the Flints, who were a godly family, and she came to faith in Christ. And she developed a severe and painful form of arthritis. And she could hardly walk and was bedridden for many years. And she had wanted to be a concert pianist, but her hands wouldn't work anymore. But she wrote verse to eke out a meager living. And she wrestled with the idea of why, if Christ healed people, why doesn't he heal me? And determined that he heals people, but for her, his grace was sufficient. That she had learned that she would rather glory in her infirmities, that the power of Christ might rest upon her. And she wrote this hymn, which is one of my favorites, and we'll close with this. The only person that can write this hymn is one that knows what the pain is like. But he gives more grace when the burdens grow greater. He sends more strength when the labors increase. To added affliction, he addeth his mercy. To multiplied trials, his multiplied peace. His love has no limit. His grace has no measure. His power has no boundary known unto men. For out of his infinite riches in Jesus, he giveth and giveth and giveth again. When we've exhausted our store of endurance, when our strength has failed ere the day is half done, when we reach the end of our hoarded resources, our Father's full giving is only begun. Fear not that thy need shall exceed his provision. Our God ever yearns his resources to share. Lean hard on the arm everlasting availing, the wings of Yahweh. The Father both thee and thy load will upbear. His love has no limit. His grace has no measure, his power no boundary known unto men. For out of his infinite riches in Jesus, he giveth and giveth and giveth again. Our God, we come to you as foreigners, as strangers, and we seek shelter under your wings. And we look to the provision and protection that you alone can give, and we look to the redemption that you provide. And we thank you that you've invited us to share in the largesse of the Redeemer who gives grace upon grace upon grace. We thank and praise you in his name. Amen.